John Adams is the missing profile in American history. You won't find his face on Mount Rushmore, minted on a coin, or engraved on a bill. 60 years ago, the U.S. Postal Service put John Adams' face on the 2-cent stamp. Since then, the Postal Service has put Bugs Bunny and Elvis Presley on first-class stamps, but never John Adams. There is no Adams Memorial. Well, maybe now. Master historian David McCullough has written another thick, choice, critically acclaimed book about an underappreciated figure from history. The book is called, with an epic simplicity its subject might have admired, John Adams. And David McCullough joins us from the studios of WABE in Atlanta. Mr. McCullough, thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning. Very glad to be with you.
And you set out to write a book about the relationship between Adams and Thomas Jefferson, didn't you?
That's right. I thought I would do a dual biography, moving back and forth, giving them more or less equal time. But I very soon found that that Adams was the one that appealed to me the most as a subject. It was just such a rich collection of letters, diaries, and it wasn't just the quantity, it was the quality of it all.
Yeah. His famous correspondence, of course, with his wife Abigail.
Which is not only extensive, I mean, over 1,000 letters between them, but I don't think either of them was capable of writing a dull letter. It's a window on that time, such as provided by no other couple and really no other founder. We can know John Adams better, closer, as a person than any other of the founding fathers.
Yeah. Let me ask you about an incident relatively early in his public career that I think is sometimes underappreciated and might define something of his character. I guess it was 1770. He was a young lawyer. 8 British soldiers, as I recall, encountered a bunch of rowdies who threw stuff at him, and they fired, and 5 people died. And this was considered slaughter and butchery. These highly unpopular, what were they called, lobster backs?
Lobster backs, red coats, they were despised.
Needed a defense lawyer, and John Adams, who was already then in favor of an independent United States, John Adams became their defense lawyer.
He was asked to defend these British soldiers, and nobody else would, and he felt that it was his obligation to do so. If we were to stand for a just society, if we were to be a civilization of laws and not of men, then these soldiers had to be represented. And not only did he defend them, he got them off. It was a brilliant performance.
You recollect a few anecdotes of his powers of locution. I'm intrigued, or particularly charmed, I guess, by the one he had a client who had to run back home and get something?
His client, he needed some papers that the client had in order to make the case for the client. And the client had to go home and get them, and so Adams proceeded to talk for 5 hours. And nobody minded in the slightest. The jury was just delighted because they enjoyed hearing him talk. You know, it was a day before television, before radio, and a great courtroom performer was a good show, and they enjoyed it.
Many Americans, I think, might have a mental image of people we still call the Founding Fathers engaged in writing this revolutionary document. And there's the vivid historical image of tall Mr. Jefferson with his red hair. Adams is obviously less better remembered, and yet, in your account, he was the commanding figure of that confab.
Well, he certainly was. And if you remember the great painting by Trumbull that hangs in the rotunda of the Capitol building in Washington, if you look at that painting, the entire focal point of the painting is on John Adams, who stands exact center, because Trumbull and all the others that Trumbull painted who had been participants knew that John Adams was the man who made the Declaration of Independence happen when it happened. Jefferson quite rightly later referred to him as the Colossus of Independence. His contribution was his determination, his absolute conviction that we not only had to sign a Declaration of Independence, but it had to be done soon. It had to be done right away. And if Jefferson was the pen of independence, Adams was the voice. Now, we have what the pen wrote, but we don't have what the voice said, because all those discussions, which were held behind closed doors, were carried on without benefit of records being, there are no transcriptions of what was said. It was too dangerous. There were too many spies, too many Tories in and about the city. Mm-hmm. And we do know that Adams spoke for 2 hours on July 1st, which was the key day. It was undoubtedly the greatest speech of his life, mm-hmm. and one of the great speeches in American history because it turned the tide.
You know, you write some of the many differences between Adams and Jefferson, and they sometimes amount to contradictions or at least points of irony. Jefferson, who is considered politically by many people still today the voice of American populism, or at least the initial voice that gave rise to that, was in fact an aristocrat. Adams, the icy, brittle intellectual, was really much more familiar with what common life was like in those days.
Well, that's exactly right. Jefferson was the one who said we must trust in the wisdom of the ordinary man, and yet he lived as far removed from the ordinary man as one could possibly be and had really relatively little to do with the ordinary man. Mm-hmm. Adams said, you've got to watch out for the ordinary man. I'm one, I know. I live among the ordinary men because if the ordinary folk, the majority, have too much power, that they can be as despotic or as dangerous as too much power in an individual. The only thing I would just add a note or two about what you said is that Adams was not icy. Adams could be abrasive. Adams could be short-tempered. He could be stubborn. But he was actually a very warm-spirited man. He was a man of great affection, great good humor.
Adams had a capacity for friendship. And his good friend Jefferson could test a friendship, couldn't he?
Yes, indeed he did. And Adams said toward the end of his life, I always loved Jefferson. And I don't doubt that that's true. And I think that Jefferson loved Adams. But the most hurtful moment in the life story for the two of them was that when Adams discovered that as did the country, that Jefferson had been paying a man to defame Adams, a professional scandalmonger, a notorious character of the time named James Callender, who was the same person who later turned on Jefferson and broke the story about Jefferson's relationship with Sally Hemings.
In the center part of your book is this description of Adams, Franklin, and Jefferson in Europe, which, that trio, there they were trying to raise money for the revolution, gain back loans, perhaps get support from eventually the French government, the Dutch government for the American Revolution. They knew each other in a way that public figures don't these days. They also were, to an astonishing degree, on their own. There wasn't a cell phone ringing with instructions from Washington or New York. They were independent agents.
Well, that's so true. And they had to make decisions on their own again and again. And Adams made one of the most important decisions of any of them on his own, which was to leave Paris, to go to the Netherlands, to go to Amsterdam and The Hague, to try and raise money to finance the war from the Dutch. And he spoke no Dutch. He knew no one in Holland before he went there. And by sheer grit, determination, he succeeded.
Hey, Mr. McCullough, could I ask you to read a section from your book?
Yes.
I found this just a wonderful portion of a letter that Abigail Adams wrote to encourage her son to go along, one of their sons, to accompany their father back to Europe. This was John Quincy Adams. He was concerned about not being able to prepare for his Harvard exams. Maybe I could get you to explain the story and read that letter.
Well, the boy is only 12 years old, and at 10 years old, he had crossed the Atlantic with his father the first time in a horrendous voyage where everything imaginable had gone wrong. They were caught in the middle of a hurricane. They got mixed up in a battle with a British ship, hit by lightning. I mean, it was just horrible, horrifying experience. And the boy came back with his father less than a year later, and then they were told they had to return once more, and young John Quincy did not want to go. But his mother knew how important this was for a young fellow, what a rare chance it was, and she insisted that he go, and she wrote him the following letter. These are the times in which a genius would wish to live. It is not in the still calm of life or the repose of a pacific station that great characters are formed. The habits of a vigorous mind are formed in contending with difficulties. Great necessities call out great virtues. When a mind is raised and animated by scenes that engage the heart, then those qualities which would otherwise lay dormant waken to life and form the character of the hero and the statesman. Abigail Adams not only could bolster the spirits of her little 12-year-old boy, she did it time and again for her husband when he would be exhausted or lonely, far away from home, working on his own. And at one point when he was in Philadelphia, early in the first days, tense times of the Continental Congress, she wrote to him what to me I think is in many ways the key to the whole story of the Adams. She said, "You cannot be, I know, nor do I wish to see you, an inactive spectator. We have too many high-sounding words and too few actions that correspond with them." Now there's a line, it seems to me, that reaches across more than 200 years to us.
It is extraordinary over the distance of history to observe the closeness of these two historical figures, John Adams and Abigail Adams.
Well, it's a true love story. It really is an exceptional case of two people with absolute devotion to each other and absolute devotion to the purpose of freedom.
Even in his last days in the White House, John Adams managed to be, let me put it this way, uniquely useful to the United States. Could I get you?
Well,
to tell
he
that
was,
story?
And he's busy trying to put the fires of war out with France. And one night, looks out the window and sees that the Treasury Department is on fire. And doesn't hesitate a minute. He's a farmer's son, let's remember, and he rushes out, runs across, joins in the bucket brigade, throwing water up onto the fire. And he certainly wasn't doing it for a photo opportunity.
Maybe an engraver opportunity, they called it in those days, I think.
Well, I was thinking that if they don't want to put a monument to John Adams up in Washington of the kind that should rank alongside the other great monuments, maybe they could at least put one over on the Treasury lawn of the President of the United States armed with a bucket trying to put the fire out there.
What did he do with the rest of his life?
Well, he went home to Quincy, and after having traveled farther in the service of the country of any of the leading figures of his day. But he went home in 1801, having left the White House, and he never went anywhere again. He stayed right at home, worked on his farm, corresponded with friends, and came to terms with himself. In writing the book, I was concerned that how could I sustain 25 more years where he doesn't go anywhere, where he has no power, no influence, no say? Mm-hmm. But in fact, I found it in so many ways the most interesting part of his story, because it becomes then an inward journey. He suffers the dreadful loss of his oldest daughter, and he suffers the death of two of his sons. He suffers the death of his wife and partner in life. But the love of life, the fire of his mind is never extinguished until his dying day.
Mr. McCullough, thank you so much.
Thank you.
David McCullough, his new book, John Adams.